أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم وصلى الله على محمد وعلى آله الطاهرين Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum rahmatullah and welcome again to this course from Ali alayhi salam to Al-Mahdi alayhi salam. This is the 11th session and so far we've covered a lot of content. So we've gone from establishing imama from the Quran, from the intellect, from the ahadith and then establishing some of the very important traits that the imams have based on the roles they have and also based other characteristics that they have that Allah has granted them. Now, we talked about a few characteristics in the last session and this idea of ghuluv and attributing too much to the imams and seeing that actually the attributes that we Shias give to our imams is not in fact ghuluv if we look at it from a Quranic, intellectual and hadithi perspective. Now, to go into more details about this whole idea of ghuluv and how it's unfolded itself in history and talk a bit about the history of transmission and how our hadith have been transmitted and how much impact has ghuluv or this idea of people who exaggerate about the imams, how much this has penetrated into our hadith corpus. We have once again with us Sheikh Muhammad Baqir. Assalamu alaikum, Sheikhana.
Alaykum assalam wa rahmatullah.
Thank you very much again for being with us. So this should be a very interesting discussion. Again, something very new for the brothers and sisters, I believe, because I don't think this is a discussion that normally gets discussed outside Hawza circles. But alhamdulillah, we've got this opportunity to bring this up because it's really an important topic in tashayyu, right? We strongly believe in our imams. It's a very deeply rooted part of faith that we have. And sometimes as Shias, we're being accused of doing shirk and of attributing to the imams things that according to others should only be attributed to Allah. What we've seen from the Quran and from the Ahadith and from our intellect, that is not the case. So now let's look into this idea of ghulu having entered our Ahadith and our Ahadith not being basically trustworthy in this sense.
A'udhu billahi min ash-shaytan ar-rajim. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Thank you very much. Before we begin, there's an interesting point that I'd like to make over here. Unfortunately, outside the Hawza circles, sometimes there's a very misrepresented understanding of how these scholarly texts work and how these scholarly sciences work.
Mm-hmm.
So we get a very basic understanding and then we start building on it and then we realize that, you know, like there's lots of things which are wrong, which is against what we've been taught from the Hawza, from the books of religion. And then we start questioning lots of things. So let me explain. What we've understood so far, what as in generally it seems outside the Hawza circles, what people seem to have understood about hadith is that it's something very simple. You have books of hadith out there, okay? And then every hadith has a chain and text, right? The hadith itself and
yeah.
a chain of which tells us how this hadith has reached the author of the book at least, yeah? Or myself, for example, how the hadith has reached us, okay? And now how do you verify the hadith? You have books called books of Rijal, where a scholar, an expert, okay, comes and he analyzes this chain, looks at the individuals who've transmitted the hadith, and then he goes and looks at each and every individual and he gives us some information about these individuals, okay? One part of this information tells us whether this individual is trustworthy or not.
Yeah.
So you'd have words like ثقتٌ, مُعتمدٌ, أمينٌ, words like these. Or you would have words like
about his غالٍ, fate, for كذب, example.
Wallah, he's a fabricator, for example. So words like this
or telling tell us about his faith or telling us about whether he's a liar or whether he's forgetful, for example.
Now what happens is we feel like this is like a telephone directory, you know. You open the book of Rijal and you'll have individuals, anyone that's not mentioned in the book, that means the scholars don't know him, so you put these people aside. Okay, people who've been mentioned in these books, and if they've been called a liar or a fabricator or even a non-Shia, for example, a Fatahi or a Waqifi, again, you put these aside because these guys are not trustworthy.
Mm-hmm.
What you have left are the real trustworthy Shia narrators.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then you go and look at the Sanad, okay, the chain.
The whole chain, yeah.
Okay, and then based on this, now you start doing 1+1. So you say, okay, X is a thika, Y is not a thika. Push aside this
and
hadith.
We put the whole hadith on the side. Okay.
Then again, X, Y, Z, all three are thiqah, so we accept this hadith. Again, X, Y, Z, first guy is on a thiqah, we push aside the hadith. Right? So this is our understanding. And once you do this, and then that's where the question comes up.
And a lot of
up,
questions and doubts that, come up because...
Look, wait, all of our hadiths are being put under question, like where do we get our religion from, what were the scholars doing, and, You know, like, and then we start giving these ideas that maybe a good amount of our religion is just like a good amount of our hadith are fabricated. Where have these hadiths reached us
I'll
from?
Go further. You know, sometimes it makes us doubt the whole thing. It makes us doubt our scholars because we feel like...
We're being lied to.
Yeah, we're being lied to. They didn't pick on that? What kind of scholars are they that they didn't pick on the fact that there's a da'if person in this
sanad? And today now we're sitting and we're like, oh my God, like finally, like, you know, I've unraveled the reality and oh my God, like, you know, it's a shocking reality.
Yeah, unfortunately. Right? And one more doubt that comes with this, and this is really important for the brothers and sisters to note, that sometimes we find chains, a hadith with completely sahih chains, and it so happens that the ulama, all of them say that this is not authentic. And again, this goes like, oh, what happened there now? I thought we were going by sahih chains. And then you have this idea that, you know, you can't trust anything anymore.
So the point I'm trying to make here is that, you know, at this rate, what's going to happen is, okay, maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but, you know, within a few years, within the next 10 years, for example, God forbid, what's going to happen is like, you know, the Quran is a guide for everyone. What are the scholars doing? They're interpreting the Quran, right? Let's do the same. The Quran is a guide for everyone, right? So why do I need to go to the Hawza and learn from individuals how to understand the Quran? The Quran is a guide for everyone. Yeah, hudan linnas. So let me just, and then why Arabic? The Quran is a guide for everyone again. Why
it's
Arabic?
Translations.
So translation, like, I mean, I'm understanding the word of God. Okay, so let's just look at the translation. Okay, let's interpret it. And then whatever I understand and it makes sense to me, I'm going to act according to it. And if it doesn't make sense to me, then I'm going to stop acting according to it. Even if all the fuqaha, the religion is one of the musallamat of the religion, is one of the badihiyat of the religion, one of the daruriyat of the religion. Right?
Just define these terms. One of the
more clear aspects of religion. Something that's been accepted by all the scholars down all these 14 centuries, 15 centuries. And we can just brush them aside because I don't understand the Quran. And, you know, I've read the Quran and I don't understand. It doesn't make sense to me. Have I looked at the hadith? Oh, sorry, the hadith are all fabricated. Okay, like, you know, all the other sciences, do you not need them? These are all commonsensical. I have common sense. We all have common sense. I mean, are you going to teach me common sense in the Hawza? No, right? So, you know, let's just push aside.
So
everything.
Basically, our understanding of this whole science of hadith is very simplistic. And what happens is that because of this simplistic mindset, when we see slight contradictions or anything like that, we come to conclusions straight away, and we're very quick in accusing scholars of this and that, whereas we should like step back and understand first what's going on, basically, right? And Sheikh Bakr feels very strongly about this because you've been digging deep into the science of hadith and rijal. So I guess you're seeing both sides of the arguments and what's happening on the different sides. So it's very interesting. Okay. So I think it's very nice that alhamdulillah we're managing to at least bring a summarized version and simplistic version again,
inshallah,
but as much detail as possible for the brothers and sisters to sort of get an understanding of this, but in light of this whole idea of hulu, right? Because we want to make it a bit into context. Just doing hadith studies in itself may be a bit dry, especially for those who don't necessarily have Hawza interest. But I think in this light of ghulu and understanding, in this light of imamat and these doubts about ghulu that we may have sometimes, then I think they'll make the discussion a bit more interesting.
So inshallah, one of the other things that we want to get to by the end of the session is hopefully inshallah the viewers be able to acknowledge, value and give more importance and understand these sciences, the Hawzawi sciences and the work and the efforts that have been taken
the
place,
role that the ulama play
These 14 centuries and the way this knowledge has reached us today, let's not take it so lightly.
Yeah,
and let's not be so quick to discard these things aside because maybe we don't understand them or we understand
makes
them
sense,
differently, at least without referring to the renowned experts in these fields, inshallah.
Makes sense.
The idea that was put out, the idea that you brought forward was that there's this claim of fabrication, right? Okay, what do you mean by the claim of fabrication? It means that, first of all, a lot of the ahadith that we have in our corpus, in our books of ahadith, especially from the initial years, right? So centuries 2, 3, 4, 5 until the 5th century, a lot of it is fabricated, okay? And especially when you use the rijal system, you realize that how much of it is weak and then you start pushing them aside.
Yeah.
And then the idea comes about that as a result of this notion, the idea comes about that, okay, a lot of what Shias believe in today and the practices that we have all evolved through the centuries, basically. They weren't the way we have them today.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So what we want to do is we want to look at We won't, obviously we can't cover so much today, right? We can't cover all the different books that we have out there, especially the books that have come to us later on, because we know generally that a lot of the books that have come to us and that were written after the 5th, 6th century were a compilation of the earlier books, right? So when we talk about Wasail al-Shia, Bihar al-Anwar, and all these books, these are compilations of previous books. So what is more important for us to look, go back and understand how did those initial books really reach us, right? In the previous session, when we were looking at the sifat of the imams, alhamdulillah, we were looking at the ahadith from the older books. So we're looking at Sheikh Kulaini, we're looking at Sheikh Saduq, Sheikh Tusi. Again, we want to stick to that system. We want to see that how did these scholars get these books, okay? And if fabrication has taken place, where can we find those, you know, rooms or patches where this fabrication would have taken place? And if we are able to seal those, close those, you know, those patches or those places where there's a void or where there was a possibility of fabrication, then we can at least trust our hadith corpus more.
Yeah.
Okay, and then later on, the books that come forward, there's again room, inshallah, for more discussion, maybe somewhere in the future.
Yeah. So just to put it into perspective, with Sheikh Kazim in the third session, I believe, the third session of the course, we had said that we could break down this this process of hadith transmission to three parts. One is where the companion himself hears it straight from the prophet or the imam. In this case, there's no room for any fabrication, right? It's authentic. You're hearing directly from the imam. Here, the only issue would be, have you understood the words properly?
Okay.
And then you have the second stage where this companion now transmits it along the generations from person to person. And this goes, okay, you'll tell us how this is being transmitted. But what we know in general is that this is being transmitted for a few centuries, until the time where a few scholars like Sheikh Kulaini, Sheikh Saduq came and compiled all of this in bigger books. And what Sheikh Kazim was suggesting is that once these were compiled, even here now, after the compilation, the room for fabrication was again reduced a lot, if not completely stopped. I don't know if it's completely reduced or not. So the place where the fabrication could have happened is in that middle time when between the companion hearing it and the compilation. So that sort of a few centuries. So is this picture?
Yeah, so definitely. So the first part is right when you hear from the imam directly. Okay, so that's fine. The second bit as well, where the books, you have compilations. Okay, they're called Jawami' Hadithi. Yeah. Okay, so you have these large books. Okay, with a lot of ahadith. Okay, so Sheikh Kulaini, Sheikh Saduq. And the scholars of that era, right? From there onwards until us, there's not much issue. There are books sometimes where you have issues.
But again, this is something that's comparatively less.
And
it's sort of under control, right?
Yeah, the scholars are not looking at these instances. What concerns us is how did the initial hadith from the imam in the earlier periods reach Sheikh Kulaini, Sheikh Saduq, and they turn into books? Because once they were turned into books, look, this is a commonsensical, this is an uqalai, this is something rational, it's a rational principle. And when something turns into a book, it's much more difficult to tamper with it.
Because when it becomes a book, it starts spreading. More people know about it becomes more popular, so definitely tampering with it is much difficult.
Okay. So what we're trying to figure out is, how did these ahadith reach Kulaini, for example, Kulaini, Saduq, how did they reach the 3rd century? And then...
So can we say like this, that the importance that we give to the books by Sheikh Kulaini, Sheikh Saduq, Sheikh Tusi, the reason why they're important is because they're the first generation of collections of a hadith
that we have today.
If
we were in Sheikh Kulaini's time, then definitely we would have more important. We would have had access to more ahadith. Now we want to talk about what kind of ahadith.
Yeah.
Okay, but what we have today, sitting here right now, we have very few single books of single scholars. You have, for example, Basair al-Darajat. You have, for example, they've been able to revive some of the books from some of these bigger books.
Yeah. Okay? So you mean the smaller books of scholars?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But like compilations, massive compilations of hadith, we have the first generation or the more important ones, and the earliest that we have right now are the Kutub al-Arba, basically the four main collections. Okay.
Yeah.
So we want to look at how these books reach where they were today.
Yeah.
Okay. So question number one, where did the idea of fabrication come from itself? Okay. So very quickly, Rijal Kashi. So there's a scholar, a renowned scholar by the name of Kashi, okay, from the Kash region. He's known as Kashi because he's from that region, okay. he's famous for his work in hadith, okay, and rijal. His book is now it was a compilation of different companions and different narrators of hadith and what information we have about them, okay, whatever he could find, okay, what has been said about them, what were they doing, where did they live, how did they travel, where did they travel, and stuff like that, okay. What is special about this book? What is special about this book is that he tries and brings in so much information. He's not limited his information to the scholarly works that these narrators have done. He's not limited his book to that. In fact, more important than that, he doesn't even speak much about the books that these scholars had. What he's trying to do is he's trying to sort out, draw out, not biographies really, but give us more information about the time of the imams, you know, the time when these companions existed, when they went to the imams, when the companions, when they lived, when they went to the imams, how did they learn their hadith, how did they acquire their hadith. So anyone who reads this book in detail gets a much better understanding of really what was happening at that time. Okay. This book, the real version doesn't exist, unfortunately, or we don't have access to it. Sheikh Tusi got access to this book, and he summarized parts of it. Okay, what we have today of Kashi, of this book of Rijal Kashi, is basically a collection or a summary or parts that were selected by Sheikh Tusi. So again, this goes on to show the importance of this book, that someone like Sheikh Tusi gave importance to selecting and removing parts of it and then passing it on to
his
students.
Why would he remove parts?
It's not so clear. There's different suggestions that have been given. That you know, there were certain things that were to do with narrators of the Sunni brothers, for example, that they weren't important, or for whatever reason, maybe there were some inaccurate details. But Sheikh Tusi took out the more important details. Maybe he made certain details more accurate and he played around with them. Okay, as in he verified them or edited them. Okay, and then what we have today from Rijal Kashi is basically a selection of Sheikh Tusi's work.
Okay. When you were saying it's trying to give us an idea of the times in that in those days when the imams were there, in what sense do you mean? Because the Rijal of Kashi is all about the details of each person, right? So what kind of things is he sort of trying to portray to us?
You get an understanding of the cultural environment at that time, because he's talking about
individuals. Is he not focusing on individuals one by one? Isn't that the purpose of the book?
Yes, he is writing about individuals, okay? So if you open his book and you'll find Zurara, for example, what you'll find is reports. So these are not necessarily ahadith. He's collected everything that he could find about Zurara, for example, or any other narrator, okay, which is important to assess his character, basically. Mm-hmm. Okay, so he'll bring you details about Zurara from the Imam, a hadith, okay? Okay, he'll bring you details about Zurara from other companions,
okay,
how the people see him, okay,
okay.
Sometimes he'll mention his own conclusions about him, okay? Okay, he gives a lot of importance to his teacher, Ayyashi, mm-hmm. Okay, now again, Ayyashi is very important, okay, because he's someone who's traveled far, he's gone to where the imams lived, to Kufa, for example. He's collected, he's learned a hadith from the seniors of the areas.
Mm-hmm.
He's come back and he's built a hawza in the Balkh Samarkand region. Okay, Kashi is learning from him, so Kashi goes up to him and asks him about different individuals. Okay, now when you put all the different texts that are there together in Kashi together, what you get is an understanding of the different eras and the different years and the different times of periods of the different companions of the different imams.
Can you say
so
the
for
different
example,
generations?
Yeah, so if, for example, you were to take Zurara and some of the other companions of Imam Bakr alayhi salam and put them together, you'd be able to sort of draw out a timeline and you'd understand, okay, what was it like in Kufa, for example, when some of these companions were in Kufa, for example, with Imam Bakr alayhi salam. Mm-hmm. Or for example, if you put all the companions together who had gone to Medina to learn from Imam Bakr alayhi salam, again, if you put them together, you learn, okay, what was the situation in Medina like when they were learning from the Imam? And same goes for all the different generations, right?
Mm.
Again, this is important because of how old this book is. Ayyashi is contemporary to Kulaini.
Okay.
So he's very close to the imams.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. So this makes this book really important. One more thing that makes this book very important is he also talks about different sort of schools of thought. Okay. Let me explain. Again, it's a very simplistic understanding that we have of history, unfortunately, that okay, we had the Ahl Sunnah, we had the Shias, for example, and at some point we had the Ismailis and the Zaydis, and you know, some of these different sects came about. This is not how it was, right? What would really happen is, for example, a new idea comes about, okay, an individual comes up with a new idea, Okay. And then he collects followers. He starts his classes. He gets a few followers. He gains support. Okay. This idea slowly turns into a sort of ideology. Okay. He gathers more people. It turns into a movement. Okay. Now this movement is going to go forward depending on who supports him and who rejects him. Okay. There's a tussle between these different groups. Okay. And then eventually either this group might die out, this faction to call it. Okay. It might die out. It might live. It might merge into a different faction. It might have change of ideology. This is how history works throughout. Okay.
So there's a lot of time that personality, that sort of, and that's why they're normally named by the personality.
So what happens now, Keshi not only speaks about this, okay, so he'll speak about individuals that might have caused a faction to come into existence, but he even has sections where he'll speak about, for example, the Ghalis. He'll speak about, for example, the Khattabis, for example. He'll speak, for example, about the Fatahis. So now he's only looking at individuals. He's looking at individuals under the Fatahi faction, but he'll group them under the Fatahi faction. So if you want to understand the Fatahis with good, accurate reports, you go to that section and then you read them and then you try and put them together. Obviously, when he's putting things, he's not giving so much importance to whether there's conflict in the reports or not. Okay, he's put them together. Okay, sometimes you might even find information in other places and stuff of the book. Okay, you put them together, you work on them, you sort out the conflicts. Okay, maybe these refer to different times and different eras. Okay, so for example, again, very quickly, and this affects hadith as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so for example, you have an individual. Okay, Ali bin Hamza Bataini, for example. When you go into the books of Rijal, to, you know, the telephone directory system, you open the book of Rijal, he's the leader of the Waqifas, for example. Oh, he's a liar. Imam prayed, Imam cursed him, and then when he died, Imam was so happy and said, Alhamdulillah, he's gone into hell. Okay. So when you open this, you open the book of Rijal, and then when you go into Hadith, and you have some amazing riwayat of fiqh, for example, from him, or you have some amazing riwayat about the Imams from him, and you look at him, and you're like, wait, he's a waqifi. Obviously, I'm not going to accept this hadith.
Yeah.
When you go into Kashi, for example, okay, it'll give you more information. Like, oh, wait, no. Ali bin Abi Hamza, for example, let's say, was one of the good companions of the Imam at some point. Maybe he was a representative of the Imam. The Imam sent him somewhere as a representative. And at one point, for example, he turned into a waqifi. And then this brings up a question to you in Rijal and Hadith. Wait, if the companions were quoting from him, were they quoting from him when he was a waqifi and he was a leader of the waqifa? Like, really, the top scholars of Shias didn't recognize him? Then how did they really tell us that he's the leader of the waqifa?
Yeah.
Right? And then you realize, oh, no, the scholars went to him and learned from him before he was a waqifi. He was a staunch Shia. Something happened at some point. He became a waqifi. And then the scholars and the narrators started refraining from him. So this is something that... This is how Rijal works. Again, this is one of the roles that this book of Kashi plays.
Yeah, very interesting. The intricacies are very interesting. You can't,
It's not black and white.
It's not black and white. It's just like, you know, when we say for the Quran, you can't just open, take a verse and start acting and you have to see, understand the whole picture. You can't just open a book of Rijal, see who's, like,
again,
one thing
again,
about
this,
him and then
like,
make
this
a conclusion.
This is, again, the delicacy of history. It's not always black and white. You really need to dig deep. It's not like an intellectual argument that, okay, you've put all the premises together and then you either reach the conclusion or not. It's not like that.
Yeah,
okay?
Yeah.
History is dealing with people. You're dealing with emotions. You're dealing with thoughts. You're dealing with ideologies. These change and shape over time, right? So you need to dig deep. You need to put all the different evidence together to be able to come to conclusions.
Yeah.
Okay. So now, very quickly, we do have two or three reports in Kashi which suggests that there was fabrication taking place.
Okay.
So I'll just read the English, okay, very quickly.
Yeah.
So this is report number 401 and 402 from Kashi, where Imam Sadiq tells his companions that he's telling his companions, don't accept ahadith easily and be strict about them.
Yeah.
Okay. Because Mughira bin Sa'id, he's again one of the leading ghalis, okay, fabricated ahadith and inserted them in the books of ahadith.
Yeah.
Or that he and his companions would take the books, fill them with fabricated ahadith and return it to the imams and the companions. Okay. Or similarly, Imam Sadiq alayhi salam says, Abu al-Khattab would fill lies. Sorry, Imam Ridha alayhi salam says that Abu al-Khattab, again, who's one of the leading ghalis, would fill lies in the name of Imam Sadiq in the books of the Shias. Okay. So we have two narrations like these. When we come across these, and these are, again, he's quoting them from the Imam, right? That the Imam himself is saying that be careful of what you quote and what you narrate, because these two leading ghalis have fabricated a lot in the name of the Imams. And they would insert it in the books and put it out to the people. So this is one of the, like, when you come across reports like these, okay, I've only found two of these, like, they're three reports really, but together. Okay, yeah, so yeah. These three reports are the only reports I've really found with regards to fabrication, like the existence of fabrication in our hadith, okay?
From the perspective of the imams, right?
Yeah.
From a historical perspective, we can
Give guesses, we can make guesses, we can look at the books of Rijal again, and there's instances where, for example, different Rijali scholars will say that Fulani is a wadda, he's a fabricator, he lies, he inserts a hadith and stuff. We're not looking at that. In terms of traditions from the imam itself, ascribed to the imam, I've only been able to come to these three narrations, okay?
Okay.
So this this makes it more difficult, right? It's like, okay, the imam is aware, and that's the serious thing. Imam Ridha is aware that fabrication has taken place, and he's sending his companion that be careful of how you take these narrations, because a lot has been fabricated in the name of Imam Sadiq and the imams to follow. Mm-hmm.
Okay. And I don't know, have you looked at the sanads of these chains?
The sanads are decent.
Are decent.
Yeah.
Okay.
So anyways, we don't want to go into this. We just said, yeah, we don't want to go into the telephone directory system. We're not going to I mean, if it comes down to a point where we have to look at the sanad, then we'll do that. But the sanads are generally good. So this is one issue. The other issue that raises the question of ghulu is this. Now, when you look at the books of Rijal, when you look at Al-Lakhwi's work, when you look at, or Al-Lakhwi is very recent, right, obviously. When you look at Ibn Ghadairi, again, who is a contemporary of Sheikh Tusi al-Najashi, again, for the viewers. So we have Sheikh Kulaini, okay, generation after Sheikh Kulaini is Sheikh Saduq. And then you can say pretty much two generations after that. So Sheikh Saduq, then you have Sheikh Mufid, and then his students are Sheikh Tusi and Najashi and Ibn Ghadairi. Mm-hmm. Sheikh Tusi, Najashi and Ibn Ghadairi are all experts in Rijal.
Yeah.
Sheikh Tusi is also an expert in many other things, okay, but they're experts in Rijal.
Yeah.
So we're looking at this period, right? Like, this, it's important to get a good understanding of what's happening, right? So when you open the book of Ibn Ghadairi, for example, you'll see that there's an all-out attack on lots of individuals, okay? Like, there's only maybe two individuals or three individuals in all of Ibn Ghadairi who he's said are fine and he's not attacked them. But then again, Ibn Ghadairi's book is a book of weak narrators.
Yeah.
Okay, it's Kitab al-Du'afa, right?
So it's a book where he's collected all the weaker.
This part of
the, weak,
of the book,
Okay,
well, now without going into discussions of Ibn Ghadairi, there's a lot that's about him, whether the book really belongs to him or not. There's a lot of there's a lot of intricate discussion that requires the experts to come and things. We don't want to go into those. We're looking at right now the history of how these ahadiths have reached us, Okay, so when you open these books of Rijal, you see a lot of narrators have been accused of ghulu and fabrication and stuff like that. So again, this brings about more questions that, like, you know, the experts are now telling us that there's fabrication. What do we do with this? Okay, to the extent that, so in that chain-based categorization, right, we have the Sahih Hadith Muwathaq Hassan, and then we have the Za'if Hadith, right?
Yeah.
They're Za'if because the narrators have been considered weak. Out of all the narrators that have been considered weak, about 85% of these narrators have been considered weak because of the accusation of ghulu.
Hmm. Wow. 85%?
If 85% of our weak narrators have been considered weak because of being accused of being ghalis.
Mm. And what you were saying yesterday's session was that scholars accuse others of ghulu because of their own beliefs. So that was the standard. So
so this is when
so does that come to play in this?
So that's what we want to look at.
Mm.
And we will get to this, right? We will get to this. In fact, if you remember in yesterday's session, we said this, that Sheikh Saduq himself, who was so strong, like at least in one of the discussions in Sahih al-Nabi, he was being so strict, right? When you look at his other works, he's the one whose narrators are Jami'ah, for example.
Yeah.
Okay. And in one of his books in Al-Khisal, for example, he comes and he says very clearly that what is the criteria of ghulu? Okay. And he quotes a hadith from the imams and he says that the imam is narrating this basically. So the imam says that inna marbubun, okay, don't call us rab, we're marbub, we're sustained by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Yeah.
Okay, faqulu ma shi'tum. Okay, so we're not Allah, don't ascribe divinity to us, don't call us Allah, okay, subhanahu wa ta'ala. Okay, but then say in our praise whatever you like.
Whatever you like. Wow.
Okay.
This is
Sheikh Saduq saying this. Okay. And again, the chain, again, if you want to look at that system, the chain is not a bad chain. According to some of the principles, you can accept the sanad.
Okay.
So.
But its attribution to Sheikh Saduq is definite.
Yeah. Sheikh Saduq has said this.
Because that means that he believes in this.
Yeah, Sheikh Saduq believes in this. He's accepted this and he said this.
Yeah.
And that's why, again, when we spoke about Sahwun Nabi yesterday, okay, we said that Sheikh Saduq had an argument for it. He said that Allah made the Prophet forget to show the people that I'm the only one who's immaculate and everyone else makes mistakes.
Yeah.
So his assumption basically over here is that being infallible, being immaculate is a trait specific to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And that's where he's flawed, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So again, it's in line with the claim that he's made or with the hadith that he's quoted.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Okay. So we said that we have traditions which, at least two or three suggestions, would say that there is fabrication. I mean, when you look at the books of Rijal again, it seems that there are narrators who have fabricated.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, or they were liars, for example, or we have issues with them. But now these narrations, okay, and this is how the fiqh of the Shias work. Okay, this is how the scholars do istinbat. Okay, you don't just look at the chain. Okay, you look at this piece of evidence. And now we want to compare it with all the evidence that we have.
Yeah.
And we really want to understand, is that really the case? Like, what can I trust? Because if you're going to tell me that there's fabrication and things have been fabricated in the name of the Imam, what can I trust? What am I left with? Right? And how do I identify what's right and what's wrong? Right? Okay. What are the implications of these narrations? Okay. Very quickly. If we accept these two or three narrations from Kashi, what we're saying is that one, companions were not able to distinguish between the right and wrong teachings of Ahlul Bayt until this time that Yunus bin Abdul Rahman goes to Imam Ridha. Imam Ridha tells him that be careful of what you take from us. And then Yunus bin Abdul Rahman starts scraping out the weak ahadith and then he starts narrating only the sahih ahadith. Okay?
Yunus bin Abdul Rahman is a companion
of Imam Ridha. Okay? So before this, Abu al-Khattab and Mughira bin Sa'id,
who were the heads of the ghulat,
the ones that Imam himself knew.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So these guys have come and fabricated things in the name of the Imam, and the Imam, the Imam hasn't done anything. The scholars and the companions of Imam Sadiq, Imam Kadhim, Imam Baqir, Imam Sadiq, Imam Kadhim alayhi salam, they did not do anything.
So Abu Khattab and Mughira were at the time of Imam Baqir.
Imam Baqir and Imam Sadiq. Okay.
So this would mean basically for the three generations of Imams, they've been quiet.
They've been quiet.
All of a sudden, at the time of Imam Ridha, Imam Ridha tells Yunus ibn Abdul Rahman, be careful.
Yeah. So this is one.
That would be the implication, yeah?
That would be the implication. Implication number two. There is no proper system in place for transmission of hadith. Right? So it's as though that, what's the system? What channel do you have to narrate hadith? Because it seems that anyone can just come in, start making up stuff, and then it just comes into your books, right?
Like today's system, right? You type anything on WhatsApp and you say Qala Sadiq, and it's accepted.
And then add a book as well. Bihar, for example.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like 110 volumes. Who's going to go and check anyways? Again, we said lack of management by Imam Sadiq and Imam Kadhim. There's one thing that you tell me that the companions weren't doing enough. But now Imam Sadiq and Imam Kadhim, alayhi salam. Also, don't forget, we always say we were proud of the fact that the fiqh al-Ja'fari and this fiqh has reached us through Imam Ja'far, alayhi salam.
I mean, Imam Baqir and Imam Sadiq were like at the forefront of that academic
pursuit. And the period was such where they were able to do tarbiyah of so many students. They were training students. The ahadith that have reached us all have the name of Imam Baqir and Imam Sadiq, alayhi salam, at large. And there's no system in place, like they're not managing, like what's going on, right? Further on, we said that, right? A few minutes ago, we said that, look, when we're dealing with people and we're dealing with ideologies, we're dealing with cultures, it takes long to change. How long did the Prophet take to be able to stop people from drinking wine, for example? Even the verses that came down in three sessions, right? In three steps, right? So you tell people slowly and slowly that, okay, change. Right? But now you're telling me that, the ahadiths are being fabricated. And like, what was the culture of the Shias? Didn't the Shias believe in things? So it's like, new ahadiths start popping up. And this is not in line with your beliefs and your culture. And it doesn't raise a question, you just accept it. And the culture changes. Now all of a sudden, Shia started believing in these supernatural things about the imams. They started believing in the idea of going to ziyarah to the imams, for example. You know? And no one raises the question that, hello, like 2 years ago, we weren't believing in these things. Like, you know, what did you just do with
us? Happening, yeah.
Wasn't
it because the companions and the real true Shia were so repressed, and there was so much going on and so much pressure from these small groups that keep popping up, the government, and wasn't it like a state of chaos?
Really?
I don't know. This is the idea that's being...
At one point, we were talking about Imam Baqir and Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. Hundreds of scholars were going and learning from him. They had the freedom and you know, the environment, because the Abbasids and the Umayyads were busy fighting with each other. The Imams had that freedom. They weren't going to prison so more often. Okay? And they had the time to work with the narrators. And yet, what's happening?
Yeah, so they were at the forefront of that knowledge, of spreading knowledge.
Yeah,
and definitely. That's when
the fact that the narrators could go to them easily. Muhammad bin Muslim, for example, leaves Kufa, comes to Medina, and stays for years with Imam Baqir alayhi salam, to learn from him. Yeah, he's learning from him. Imam Baqir alayhi salam tells, and Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, they encourage their companions to go and teach the people to give fatwa, to do ifta in the masjid. Right, so these people are at the forefront of this, you know, this training, and all of a sudden, beliefs are changing, and no one is raising questions, no one is poking fingers, yeah. So, this is something that needs to be looked into.
Okay,
right, okay, we can keep going on. There's so many different implications over here. Like again, it goes back to the channel that is being used. But how many books do we have? So, for example, you're my teacher. Okay, I'm listening to hadith from you. You've gone to the imam, you've learned a few hadith. I come to you and I learn from you, right? Because that's how the chains work, right? I'm learning from you. Now, where is this hadith? Is this being written down? Is this being just, you know, is word of mouth? Where does Abu al-Khattab and Mughira, where do they come in and cause the fabrication? If it's books, so is it that you wrote a book from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, I come and take the book from you and then I pass it to someone else, and one night someone just gets into my house, makes a few changes?
Basically, we don't know what's going on, okay? This is not something that we've been taught in madrasa, okay? How is this happening?
Okay. And one more, again, important point. The scholars, they weren't even rechecking their work. I mean, it's just, you know, like, it's funny, really. Things are just passing and no one is doing anything about it. Like, it's frustrating.
Yeah. So I think the idea that's normally spread out there is this, that there was so much pressure. There's a lot of ideas going. It's basically chaos, okay? There's a chaos going around. Nobody knows who's doing what. And books are being tampered. Hadiths are maybe being added, you know, somewhere. And the author might not notice it. I don't know. There's clearly a lack of understanding of exactly what's happening. So this is where you come in, basically.
So let's go into a few steps and let's understand get into this perspective of the historic aspect of it, basically. Okay. So first, let's understand what the teachings of the Ghulat were. We spoke about it from the Quranic perspective and. Yeah. The ahadith that were in line from the Quran. But let's look at how ghuluv has been mentioned in ahadith.
Yeah.
Okay. So, one very interesting hadith from Sheikh Tusi. Okay. He says, قال الصادق عليه السلام, that protect your youth from the ghulat. Let not the ghuluv spoil and corrupt your youth. And the ghulat are the worst of Allah's creation. So, okay. Why? Because they belittle the majesty of Allah. How? Mm-hmm. By ascribing partners, right?
Yeah.
Okay. And they claim rububiyah for the servants of Allah, for the imams, for example. Okay. And then he says, إِلَيْنَا يَرْجِعُ الْغَالِي فَلَا نَقْبَلُهُ. So the ghali at some point comes to us because he believes in us, right? He's claiming that we're, for example, we're the Rab, we have the divine sifat. Okay. So the ghali comes to us, فَلَا نَقْبَلُهُ. We don't accept him.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And then the narrator says, كيف ذلك يا ابن رسول الله? So Imam says, لأن الغالي قد اعتاد ترك الصلاة والزكاة والصيام والحج فلا يقدر على ترك عادته. So the ghalis, they've gotten so used to forsaking the wajibat, salat and sawm and hajj and zakat, that even when they come to us and we tell them what's right and what's wrong, they're not able to let go of their habit. And what do we get out of this? That the ghulat had two main characteristics. One that we've already spoken about, the idea of shirk and claiming rububiyyah and uluhiyyah for the imams. And a practical characteristic was that they were forsaking the wajibat and muharramat.
So that they weren't practicing the sharia of Allah.
They weren't practicing the sharia. Okay. Mm.
Would you say they were more of that type of the people who follow the inner aspect of religion and forsake the outer aspect?
The ghulu ideology has definitely affected, as in you can say that this ideology that just stick to the batin, for example, and these inner deeper things and let go of the zahir, has its roots in these ghali ideologies.
Okay. Interesting.
So yes, it's you can't say that they're completely unlinked.
Yeah.
Okay. So, in another historic piece, okay, so this is not from the imam, it's from Qadi Nu'man, who died in 363 AH. So again, it's very old, okay? He says in his book, he's speaking about the times of the imams, okay? So he says that, he's speaking about the ghulat, and again, Mughira bin Sayyid and Abu al-Khattab, and he says they left deen, they left the religion, okay? They started turning the haram into halal. So things like incest, for example, and alcoholism was made halal by these individuals. Okay.
So blatantly leaving the sharia.
Openly. Okay. And then Abu al-Khattab even goes to the imam. The imam rejects him. Okay. And then what he starts doing is he starts calling Imam Sadiq Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. And he starts calling him ilah. And he says, I am his prophet. Okay. So first he says, okay, the imam is the prophet. I am his imam, for example. Then he takes it further up and he says that, okay, no, imam is ilah and I am his prophet. And so now it's as though I have the sharia in my hand. Mm. And I can.
So he allows himself to play around with it.
Yeah. Okay. So he claimed prophethood for himself. Okay. His companions would go up to him and, you know, they'd be like, we can't carry out these acts of worship, for example. Or we can't stick to some of the wajibat. And he'd be like, okay, let go of it. Like, I'll make it easy for you. So this is what wudu really was. Okay, so you can imagine now that we're in a time where there's a group of people, there's a faction, which all of a sudden they're coming up with these ideologies that, you know what, let go of wajib and haram. Mm. I mean, it's one thing, you don't go around brandishing your aqaid everywhere, right? So it's not like they go on the streets talking about, oh, Imam Sadiq is Allah, Imam Sadiq is Allah. That's one aspect of it. Right. But practically what's seen from them, these guys don't care about salat. They don't go to the masjid, and not to mention the sins that they're committing. So it goes to this point.
Okay.
Funnily, some of these, just to show the impact of that these guys created, right? Imam Sadiq alayhi salam curses him, okay? Abu al-Khattab. He curses Abu al-Khattab, okay? And even prays to Allah that may he be killed by hadith, by the metal, by the sword. And the caliph, the Abbasid caliph, Mansur, is the one who gives the order for his execution. So it's not that the ghulat were just affecting the Shias, or for example, this ghulat came into the Shia ideology and the Shia group.
They were bothering the government.
It was
as well.
The whole community, the whole Muslim community at large. That was
everyone
was
annoyed
the
by them.
Kufa
yeah.
especially, and then the cities that followed were all being affected by these ghulat.
Okay. So I have a question here. I don't know if I'm skipping things, but if this is what ghulu is about, then why did we say that Sheikh Saduq criticizes those who don't believe in Sahu Nabi to be ghulat? I mean, what's his definition then?
Let's move on, because right now we're at the time of Imam Baqir and Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, right? Okay. As we move forward, we'll reach the time of Kulaini and Saduq.
Okay,
and
so
we'll
I did skip, but I went a bit too fast forward. Okay, so before we continue, I think we should take a short break because it's been a while. So it's been very interesting. Let's get ourselves fresh again to continue the second part of the discussion. So brothers and sisters, we'll be back in a few moments, inshallah. Just get yourself refreshed and inshallah we'll continue.
دستم و امداد علی باده به من داد علی در دلم افتاد علی در دلم افتاده علی. هل امروز امیرت در میخانه توی، هل فریاد رسه این دل دیوانه توی. کعبه یک سنگ نشانیست که ره گم نشود، تا بدانن همه صاحب این خانه توی. مست علی، مست علی، دائم و پیوست علی، دست علی دست خداست، چشم من و دست علی، دست علی دست خداست، چشم من و دست علی. دوش دیدم که ملائک در میخانه زدن، همه با ذکر علی، همه گی مست علی، گل آدم به سرشتند و به پیمان زدن، همه با اسم علی، همه سرمست علی، با من راه نشین باده مستان زدن، همه با یاد علی، همه با وست علی، قرعه فال به نام من دیوان زدن، همه با عشق علی، همه با دست علی. راه علی، ماه علی، ماه علی، راه علی، دل بر دل خواه علی، یار علی، دلدار علی، حیدر کرار علی، حیدر کرار. صحن ایوان نجف باز مرا راه بده، در طواف حرمت فرصت تکرار بده، ای نسیم سحر آرام گه یار کجاست، وقت مرگم نفسی مهلت دیدار بده، مهلت دیدار بده. دوش وقت سحر از غصه نجاتم دادم، من در آن ظلمت شب آب حیاتم دادم، باده از دام تجلی صفاتم دادم، مستحق بودم و اینها به زکاتم دادم، عمر من تن شده در راه تولای علی، با حسین و حسن و زینب و زهرای علی، خورده هم زخم به امید مداوای علی، تا بلندم بکند دست تولای علی، دست تولای علی. مست علی، مست علی، دائم و پیوست علی، دست علی دست خداست، چشم من و دست علی، چشم من و دست علی. مست علی، مست علی، دائم و پیوست علی، دست علی دست خداست، چشم من و دست علی، چشم من و دست
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum. Welcome back to the session. We were discussing with Sheikh Baqir the topic of transmission of a hadith in light of the movement of ghulu, the people who used to exaggerate about the imams and give them divine attributes. And so we were discussing how they infiltrated and affected our corpus of a hadith. And we had just finished talking about certain implications about this idea that the ghulat have really tampered with our hadith. And we had just finished that and moving on from that. Okay.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So we understood now the challenge that the imams and the companions are facing, right? And the understanding of ghulu from the ahadith. Okay. Now, what should imam do? He's facing these ghalis with the idea of letting go of religion altogether, and calling certain individuals, the imams themselves, as gods. So, what should the imam do? Two obvious things. Okay. one, he openly starts cursing these individuals.
Okay.
He makes it clear that he's disassociated. Bear in mind also, Abu al-Khattab and Mughira bin Sa'id both were initially companions of Imam Bakr alayhi
salam. Okay. Interesting.
They went deviant. Okay. And they went deviant for different reasons. Okay. And when this happened and it became clear to the Imam started cursing them openly. Such that even when companions would come to them and they would mention their names, the Imam would criticize and curse these individuals in front of the companions. Okay. So and he I made guess it that clear that he's disassociating. And whatever he tells you, fair enough, until now maybe he was a scholar, he was a companion, you were learning a hadith from him. But henceforth, he's got nothing to do with me.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that was like one of the important responsibilities of the Imam, to do tabarra from these people, to dissociate himself from them.
Definitely, right? I mean, if he doesn't, you'd question his isma.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly.
And you'd question, and not just his isma, his intellectuality, his wisdom, his hikmah as well, that any leader, if he sees an individual from his own school and his own group and his own faction going
so
against...
So deviating like completely,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, changing the entire teachings. Here we have Islam emphasizing on the importance of wajib and haram, and this guy comes out and says, no, you know what, you don't need to do any of this. You know, there's like 180 turn, right?
Mm.
So the Imam starts disassociating from these individuals. Okay. The next thing he does, again, very obvious. The Imam wants to make sure that the immaculate teachings reach the community, right? So what he starts doing is, he starts giving more importance to his close companions and starts mentioning their names more openly. So again, when individuals come to Imam, the Imam starts praising and mentioning his companions very openly to them. Like hold on to Zurara and Muhammad bin Muslim and Jamil, Buraid, and all these different companions. These are, for example, he says, Kana Abi, so Imam Sadiq alayhi salam is telling one of his companions, Kana Abi i'tamanahum ala halalillah wa harami. My father entrusted these companions with the wajib and the haram. وَكَانُوا عَيْبَةَ عِلْمِهِ. These individuals knew and had the knowledge of the Imam, as in from the Imam, they learned from the Imam, they knew the secrets of the Imam, they were really close to the Imam. وَكَذَلِكَ الْيَوْمْ هُمْ عِنْدِي. These people, even today, they are my companions, because again, these generations, Imam Bakr alayhi salam passed away, the companions were students of Imam Sadiq then, right? إِذَا أَرَادَ اللَّهُ بِأَهْلِ الْأَرْضِ سُوءًا صَرَفَ بِهِمْ عَنْهُمُ السُّوءُ. So when Allah, if He wills to, you know, like He wants a calamity to befall the earth or the people of that city, because of these individuals, He pushes away that calamity. These individuals are so pious and they're so important, okay? And we want you all to hold on to these companions, yeah? Interestingly, I mean, it was so clear that this, you know, this cultural movement is going on. Is the Imam is educating the companions. He's telling the companions who are the maraji that you need to refer to. Mm. So if you don't have access to me, you have to go to these individuals. It was becoming so common. Yeah.
Maraji in his literal sense of being a source
point
of
reference.
Yeah.
Point of reference. It was becoming so obvious that, for example, Jamil over here says, وَكُنَّا نَعْرِفُ أَصْحَابَ أَبِي الْخَطَّابِ بِبُغْضِ هَؤُلَاء. So Jamil, okay, he's a student of Zurara, he's saying that we would identify the companions of Abu al-Khattab, the Ghali, by their hatred for these close companions of Imam Bakr and Imam Sadiq alayhi salam. So like this tussle is so clear, and like the sides were divided so clearly. Hatta yatabayna rushtu min al-ghay. Yeah, you know who the right side is, you know who the left wing is, and you know you're not going, not the left wing, you know that these are the deviants, we want to stay away from them. Right, so he's
so
sort
it
of
wasn't basically
vaccinating
a,
his community.
It wasn't a hidden movement that nobody. They just infiltrated into.
Yeah,
you
it was
know,
clear.
It was
know,
very
the,
clear
the,
who they are.
You know,
yeah.
The marks on their forehead made it clear that okay, you mentioned Zurara, you mentioned Muhammad and Muslim. This guy is
they
going to get
upset.
So we move on. What else is the Imam doing? The Imam again is training these superb companions, right?
Yeah.
Okay. What kind of companions are we looking at? We're looking at companions who are not only top and like they're not the most classified and the superb fuqaha of their time. They're not just the strongest theologians and the strongest companions in terms of aqaid or in the different sciences. No, these individuals are extremely pious individuals as well. They hold on to the wajib and haram, and they themselves are examples for us, just like the imams are examples for us. Yeah. So for example, you have Safwan bin Yahya. Again, I'm mentioning different companions.
Yeah.
Safwan bin Yahya is again one of the companions of Imam Ridha alayhi salam. They say about him that there were three friends, Safwan and two of his friends. They made a pact that whoever passes away, whoever lives the longest between the three of them, would pray and fast and offer ibadat for in niyaba for them. So Safwan lives the longest. So now he starts praying. He prays his own 51 rak'ah every day. And at the same time, he's praying 51 each for each of his companion every day.
Wow. That's next level.
When he does Umrah, he does Umrah for his companions. When he does pays zakat, he pays zakat for his companions as well. So he's doing every wajib three times. Right? These are the companions we're looking at. You have Hassan bin Ali al-Faddal. He'd go out into the desert and he'd do an ibadah such that one of the companions says that I went to the desert and I felt that there's ragged pieces of clothes out there in the desert. And then he would get up and you'd realize that there was this individual who was in prostration for so long.
Hmm.
Yeah.
So these are the companions who were emulating their imams, right? These are things we've heard about Imam Ali and other imams. So yeah, these are companions who are literally embodying and following the footsteps of their imams.
Yeah, and then each of these companions, they acknowledge the superiority of their teachers as well. Mm-hmm. So for example, Muhammad bin Abi Umayr, again, when you read about him, like the amount of prayers and worship that he would do, he tells his teacher, sitting with his teacher Jameel, like in the one we mentioned right now, and he's telling him that, Subhanallah, look at your classes, how many people are coming and benefiting from you. Yeah. And then Jameel says, this is nothing compared to how we would benefit from Zurairah, for example.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's so clear, is subhanAllah.
That like teacher-student relationship, the closeness.
The closeness, the taqwa, yeah. The piety, the link that they have between the wilayah, the brotherhood that they have between them, and how they're linked to the imam. Yeah, and this is spreading through them into the community. So now you can imagine even the community, how this community is being shaped, right?
Hmm.
Okay, again, you have... I mean, we can keep going on, right? So let's just move on.
Let give a few more examples if you have them, because it's really nice to hear about the companions. I really feel we failed to really appreciate what things were going on at that time. Mm-hmm. And I think knowing more of this helps us really to appreciate how strong our legacy that we have of these, and the heritage we've got from the imams, is how strong it is.
Yeah. We need courses on these, really. Like we need. Now, one of the teachers would say that you need to sit with a teacher who's an expert, okay, and go through Rijal Kashi from the start to the end to understand the environment, this get into this perspective, understand what the companions were doing, who these companions were. Yeah. So for example, Zurara, who is Zurara, for example? Yeah. The Imam tells him, okay. So now what happens is, one of the things, again, this is very interesting, okay, maybe it's not completely linked. What happens is, we've seen right now the enemies. And there's lots of individuals who are becoming enemies, and it's a reality, right? When you speak the truth, at some point you're going to make enemies for yourself.
Of course, yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay. So Zurara is making enemies. People hate him because he's going and speaking out the truth. He's becoming like the Abu Dhar of his time, right? So there's a time where he's being told that don't worry if someone comes and tells you that your imam has said something negative about you. Zurara's like, wait, like, why is this happening? And the imam is saying, look, I fear for you. I worry about you. So sometimes if I'm in a situation where I need to speak ill about you for your life so that people don't like attack you, for example, or they feel that, you know what, okay, the imam also is not so happy with him and stuff, okay, then I do that. I end up doing that. So you might hear sometimes a report saying that the imam said bad about you, for example, but don't mind, okay, like let go of it. And then the imam starts telling him that you're like that safe boat that takes the community of the Shias through a stormy sea and takes them to salvation, takes them to safety. This is who Zurara is, for example.
Mm.
Again, you have Yunus bin Abdul Rahman. Okay, at his time, he was a very strong. He was one of the strongest fuqaha at the time of Imam Ridha alayhi salam. So you have two extremely strong. Again, in every age, you have extremely strong. Some narrators become much more famous and much more stronger. Okay, because of their knowledge and because of their closeness to the imam. So at the time of Imam Ridha alayhi salam, this Safwan that we just mentioned and Yunus bin Abdul Rahman, they're extremely close to the imam. They're the top two narrating the scholars of their time. Okay.
Yeah.
Again, 2 points about them. The waqifis, okay, those individuals who stopped at the imamate of Imam Kadhim alayhi salam, they did tawakkuf, they stopped at him, they didn't accept the imamate of Imam Ridha. These guys had a lot of money. One reason why they became waqifas was because one of them, Ali bin Abi Hamza, he had money, he was a wakil of Imam Kadhim alayhi salam, he was his representative. When Imam Kadhim passed away, when he became shaheed. Again, there was a reason why this what happened. But this guy had a lot of money in his account. When Imam Ridha writes to him that send me the money, this guy says that no, I'm not sending you the money. And then like he brings up this whole notion that Imam hasn't passed away, he's in ghaiba, he's going to come back, he's the Mahdi, for example.
Okay. And so they concocted those stories partly because of that money that they had in their hands.
So now these guys, and they had a lot of money, right? They had money from homes, and zakat that was supposed to reach the imams. Okay. Now these guys go around spending this money like for publicity and for getting people into their group, for gaining support. So there's a lot of companions, not necessarily because of the money, but because of the fact that Ali ibn Abi Hamza and some of the Waqifis, they were like renowned scholars of their time. When you see that these scholars have turned, then you're like, wait, okay,
sort of makes you doubt.
We know that there's 12 imams, we know that there's these ideas, okay, we've heard of all of this, but he was so close to the imam, you know?
What happened, basically, yeah.
So sometimes for a moment you slip.
Yeah.
Okay? So these two individuals, Safwan and Yunus bin Abdul Rahman, the Waqifas themselves, they come and they accept that we did everything we could to get these guys on our side. But these guys stuck staunch Shias, okay? And they kept challenging and fighting these individuals.
Mm-hmm. It reminds me of the Salman and Abu Dhar of Imam Ali.
Yeah, and then eventually a lot of the Waqifas, they came back and they became Ithna Asharis.
Okay, so we have this moving back to the Ithna Asharis.
Yeah, right? Definitely. There were few who ended up remaining Waqifis, but a lot of them moved back. I mean, at the end of the day, Haq shows itself, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Also, again, Yunus, again, these people of Baghdad, they come to Imam Ridha alayhi salam to complain about Yunus. Because Yunus is like someone who's... again, he's very intellectual. He knows the secrets of Imam. He understands. It's very easy for us today to put all the Quran and Hadith together and understand these realities that have reached us after years of work that the scholars have done. When you have scholars like Kulaini all the way until you have Mufid, and then in our days you had Allama Tabatabai, Shaykh Mutahari. When you've had these, it's very easy for us to understand what they've taught us and then come and explain these, right? But when you have Yunus at that time, okay, and he's understood these realities which people don't. So now people come to Imam Ridha alayhi salam and complain that this guy has become a zindiq. And Yunus is standing behind the curtains and he's listening to all of this, right? And he starts crying. And then when the people leave, he comes out to Imam Ridha and he's like, these guys are calling me a zindiq. Like, what's... And the Imam says, don't worry. No, don't worry. These guys don't understand what you say. Speak at their level. Like, don't go beyond them. They don't understand what you're saying. Just let go of them. Just deal with them at their level. They'll slowly learn. But don't let it bother you. Let's stop you from doing the work that you're doing. I'm with you. I approve of the work that you're doing and carry on. Okay. So now these are the companions we're looking at. And the imams are constantly training these companions. Okay. Now what happens? So we've said that the ghulat were focusing on two aspects, right? One was the belief system. Okay. And their deviated belief. Okay. About uluhiyah and rububiyah. Okay. About tawheed. Okay. But it showed itself in these practical aspects, right? We're saying that what we're looking at is individuals who are letting go. There's no abidance to any law whatsoever. And that's why the caliph himself orders their assassination, right? Okay. So now what happens is these companions take up a strong guard for fiqh. Okay. That we want to train and teach the people about fiqh. Because this is the image of our community. This is the symbol of our community. This is what shows outside that these the Shias, they're very staunch, they're biased, they pray, they offer salat.
They give importance to the apparent of the religion.
Yeah,
they don't let go of the
zahir of the religion.
Which is very much in complete contrast with the ghulat,
exactly,
basically.
Right. So now the Imam is working with them. The Imam is working with them, he's training with them, such that you have traditions where, for example, these two traditions from Imam Kadim alayhi salam, okay, one of them says that he's telling Imam Kadhim alayhi salam that fuqihna fi din, we've become faqih in the religion. You've made us a faqih. We've become
faqih.
Faqih
means somebody with deep
understanding. We understand the religion. We understand all the different aspects of the religion. Okay? And aghnanallahu bikum anin nas. Through you, Allah has made us needless of the people. Of the people meaning to say the other sects. The other schools of thought. Allah has made us needless of these other schools of thought. We know we've learned so well from you. You've taught us so well, alhamdulillah, that now we know what the religion is. Yeah. And then he says, for example, that when we're sitting in gathering, sometimes questions come up and we always have something written from you. وعندنا فيه شيء مستتر. We always have something written from you, and we know what the ruling is. Or if we don't, we quickly discuss and we do an istinbat. We're able to come to the conclusion based on the teachings that we have from you. So the companions, obviously, there's not all of the religion. They have not necessarily heard everything from the imams. We understand that, right? Yeah. But they feel confident as well. They know that the culture, the knowledge has become so rich now with the teachings that we have from Imam Bakr all the way to Imam Kadhim alayhi salam. So this is what's really happening, right?
So very well-equipped companions with a good understanding of the religion.
Quickly jump to Kafi. When you look at Kafi, how many narrations do you think we have from Abu al-Khattab? You know, everything has reached Kafi, and we want to play with the Sanad, for example. We want to look at what's right and what's wrong and remove a good amount of the book, for example. How many narrations do you have from Abu al-Khattab? There's two narrations from Abu al-Khattab.
Okay.
In Kafi. Both places, it's mentioned that this was narrated from him fi zamani sihatihi or fi hali sihatihi, for example, the time when he was still a Shia.
But isn't it the idea that they put in the hadith and
we'll come to that. We'll come to that. But look at this again. This the idea of separation between the different factions, according to what we have right now, at least, what's on paper, is that it's so clear that even when someone now quotes from Ali bin Abi Hamza, when someone quotes from these deviants, they make sure to mention.
So the deviants were clear, basically. We know who they were.
Now, this is the most important question. How did these hadiths reach the books today? Okay. There's one time we're playing in a different school of thought or in a different understanding. For example, the brothers of the Ahlus Sunnah, we say that, you know, a lot of the ahadith were transmitted by word of mouth and memory. There were the ideas of huffaz, people who were the hafiz, and they would have learned how many thousands of hadiths, tens and thousands of hadiths. And then at one point, the ban was lifted, and then you had to start writing everything. Yeah, you had to just find people and start writing and compile as much as you can. Obviously, there were books even in the Ahlus Sunnah. It's not like that there were no books. But
so there was a ban from the time
after the time of the Prophet until the first 100 years. Right?
First 100 years, but there were a few books here.
There were books that were being written. Okay, but the general from as far as the government was concerned and the official establishment was concerned, you weren't allowed to write and produce books, right?
And that includes in the Khulafa time, right?
Yeah. Okay. So this is what's happened. If we play in that area, or we try and think that, okay, you know, we didn't have books, for example, or people came and learned from the imam, and then they would go away, they would remember, and then at one point they would pass it down through word of mouth. Yeah, and then that's why it's so important to, you know, make sure that each and every individual in the link, how is he a thiqah, is he not thiqah? When we think about it in this way, then it makes sense to do what the idea is out there. But what's really happening? The imams, Imam Bakr, Imam Kadhim, if you especially look at the ahadith of Imam Bakr, because Imam Bakr is at this phase where the culture is at that point of turn, right? Until before him, there was oppression. Yes, the Shias were in that sort of secrecy. They were hiding. It wasn't so clear. The Shias didn't even know clearly their ahkam necessarily before Imam Bakr alayhi salam. So when Imam Bakr comes, the political environment eases up a bit. Okay, then Imam Bakr alayhi salam has more time and opportunity to now work with the people at and train companions. What does he start doing? He starts speaking about the importance of gaining knowledge. He speaks about it. A whole culture comes into existence. The importance of becoming a scholar, to become a faqih, to come and learn the religion. Okay. Individuals start coming to Imam Bakr alayhi salam. Many of these top individuals, companions that we have, Zurara, for example, they weren't even Shias. They heard of the Imam, they came to the Imam, and then they accepted, they saw the truth, and then they accepted, right? So they became Shias. These companions now, they come to the Imam and they're becoming faqih, because the Imam mentioned and spoke about them. He injected the whole idea of becoming a faqih, that a faqih is more important than abid, for example. The blessings and the mercy that a faqih receives and how he affects the whole community is much more important than that.
Basically abid. Highlighting the importance of knowledge, basically. Yeah.
So now this faqih, okay, so now scholars started becoming faqih. These individuals came, they get close to Imam Bakr, they started becoming fuqaha, as in experts of religion, in different dimensions. Okay.
Which is interesting, because today, after all these years, we're saying we don't need experts in religion. We can just open the Quran and know.
And this is something that's come directly from the imams.
Yeah, and the imams were actually doing this. They were making experts in religion.
Okay. Once that happens, now what? Okay, I've become a faqih. Now what do I do? The imam starts putting in the culture of, okay, write what you're learning. And Sheikh Kazim mentioned in the sessions, right? The Imam would be like, no, come with your pen and paper and write everything. If you're blind, Abu Basir, for example, find a different way. Get the guy who comes and helps you, for example, to walk and stuff. Get him to come and write for you. Or make sure there's a system in place. You have to write. I want you to write. Okay? So now they started writing. Now what do you do?
So this ban that was there for the first few years, was it something that the Shias were abiding by?
The Shias, not so much. But because of the situation the Shias were in, we don't have so many books from those periods either. We have books that were written, okay? But not a lot of these books. We don't have so many books, first of all, okay? Because the situation was such that how many people were really going to the Imam, sitting down to learn the Ahkam and the religion, for example. The situations were such, okay? And even when books were written, a lot of these books haven't come down to us, okay? So a lot of the main work that's come to us really is from Imam Baqir and Imam Sadiq's time. Okay. So now books are being written by these companions. Now what do we do? So now the Imam says, okay, get students and start writing. Get students, start training students. Okay. And the idea of Sima and Qira'ah came into existence. Which means that you're my teacher. Okay. You've gone to the Imam. You've learned a hadith. You've learned a hadith, you've written them down in your book. You've published a book now. So you have a book of yourself with 100 traditions from Imam Sadiq Ali, some directly from him, for example.
Okay.
Now you come to me, as in I come to you technically, okay? I take your book, I copy all of it, okay? I return the main book to you. Now I have a copy of the book, okay? And now either I read all of it in front of you and you approve of it, okay, that's called qira'ah. I read, I do qira'ah in front of you as my teacher and you approve of all of it.
Yeah.
Or the other way around, sima. I listen to you whilst you read it out for me and basically you teach me the whole book. Once that happens, okay, you approve of this manuscript, okay, and you give me this ijazah tahdith. You give me the permission to go and now teach this book again to other students, to the next generation.
So teaching in this atmosphere meant literally dictating the hadith and passing them on to the next person.
Yeah.
From a book that is being approved by the actual first author that heard it from
now
the Imam.
So now books are not just passing through word of mouth. In fact, there's no word of mouth. After Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, and definitely Imam Kadhim, Imam Ruda alayhi salam, the hadiths we have are all in the form of books. Okay. We don't have this idea of word of mouth, for example, and then character assassinate every individual and okay, we'll come to that. Okay, but the point is that everything that's come to us is in the form of books. From that time, books are being written down. And then these books are being passed from generation to generation in this complex system where you have to go to the teacher. The teacher sits with you after you've copied the whole book from him. Okay, and you sit with him, you learn the whole book with him. Okay, and then you get permission to now go and transmit this book. Okay, do we have proof for this? Yes, we have lots of proof for it. Okay, very quickly, for example. Okay, Ibn Sinan goes to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam, okay, one of the companions of Imam Sadiq, goes to Imam Sadiq alayhi salam and tells him that people are coming to me in large numbers to listen to the hadith from me, okay? And I can't manage, like, how often can you read the whole book again and again and again and give permission, right? So in this case, in this specific instance, because the idea is that you can't break this rule. This is how
books are supposed established to move rule,
yeah. So the Imam tells him in this case that, okay, read to them from the start of the book, a bit of the start of the book, a part from the middle of the book, and a part of the end of the book. Well, make sure that you take the book through the established method, basically. So don't read the whole book, cover to cover. You can't do that, fair enough, okay? But make sure that you do a good amount of the book with the people, okay? If someone didn't stick to the system, he was shunned. So again, Ahmad bin Muhammad bin Isa Ash'ari Qumi, you remember him, right?
Yeah, the guy who was sleeping out.
He's the senior leader of Qom at one point, and then he expelled four people from Qom, four or five individuals from Qom. Okay, so he leaves Qom, he goes to Kufa, okay, seeking hadith, so he's still a student, okay? And he goes to Al-Hasan bin Ali al-Washa, okay? And he tells this teacher that I want permission for the book of your teacher, okay, or for one of the teachers, okay. So Al-Hasan bin Ali al-Washa gives him the book, okay. Say, okay, go make a copy of it and come back. And then he says, can you just give me the ijazah as well so that I can narrate the book? And the teacher is like, well, why are you in a hurry? Like, we have a system in place. You can't change this system. Why are you in a hurry? And he's like, I'm worried that, you know, something happens. I pass away, or I don't get, or you pass away, for example, I don't get permission. You know, then I'll be stuck. I mean, I'll have the book, but I won't have the permission to do tahdith.
Yeah.
If I go out there, no one's going to take this book from me. And this has happened as well. Again, there's more proof. I won't read the Arabic, but there were books by individuals, top scholars of hadith. These books didn't get into the hawza or the market of books, basically. Okay, they remained where they were. No one was ready to take these ahadith from them and learn from them, because they didn't have the proof of sima and qara'ah. Or, for example, they made it clear that we didn't do sima and qara'ah. We only have the ijazah of tahdith. We have the permission from the teacher to narrate the book, but we've not gone from this traditional system. Okay, the official system. So we've not gone through
it. We haven't followed the system, and therefore this
they were stuck with these books, and then the scholars of Rijal wouldn't accept these books into the system. The scholars of hadith wouldn't quote from these individuals. So the book is out there. Okay, it's even, for example, known at some point in the initial years, you've produced a book, it's known that this book has been produced by this scholar. By one point then, this book gets forgotten. It's left alone. Like, no one's taken this book.
So we have a whole system that's pretty strong, that's ensuring that books are gone through from teacher to student and being passed on like this. Yeah. And the Rijalis were aware of this.
Yeah, and again, all of this that we're saying right now is from the books of Rijal, right? This evidence and these narrations are all from either Rijal Najashi, okay, who's the expert of Rijal at his time.
Yeah.
Okay, he's even, many scholars agree that he's even expert in Rijal than Sheikh Tusi. Sheikh Tusi is very strong in all the different sciences. He's very comprehensive. He's a very comprehensive scholar. But he's not the expert at Rijal, whilst Najashi is the expert at Rijal. Yeah. So a lot of this thing is from Rijal Najashi. We're taking a lot from Rijal Kashi. Okay. When you look into Rijal Najashi, okay, you find records that at least 500 books became so prominent because the top scholars produced these books. Okay. What happened was then large numbers of students would come to this individual. Okay. And they would do the sima and qara'ah. So at the same point, at one instance, this scholar is teaching his old book, okay, and a large number of students have now got ijazah to do tahdith of this book, to now come and spread this book further. They go and again further spread this book, and this keeps going on until the time of Kulaini. So Najashi himself, for example, mentions which books have reached him through this process. Right? So it was quite clear that, okay, there are books that are coming through this process. Yes, some books, for example, that some scholars, for example, maybe they might not have been so careful. They might have somehow find a path to just narrate books and just give ijazah at some point in the later years. Okay, but initially the system was strongly in place. And you know how these books have transmitted and reached the scholars of Rijal. So Najashi makes it clear that, okay, this book has reached me through Sima and Qara'ah, from this chain. Okay, we have like more than 500 books that were mass produced in this way. You know, it's like a whole system of publication.
Publication.
You produce a book. Atlas Sistani over here, may God protect him, releases, for example, his latest version of the Risala. Or imagine for the Hawza, he releases latest version of a book on Fiqh or Usul. No, we'd rush to get his book and then now start mass publishing it, get teachers to come and teach it to us. Yeah. And get those teachers ideally who've studied under him, so that we understand his principles properly, rather than get someone to try and figure out what Sayyid has said. Right? This is exactly what's happening from right those days.
Very interesting. So what does this mean in terms of making up sanads or adding stuff to the books? Is there room for this?
Okay. So
because as you said that we don't have, Abul Khattab, for example, wasn't quoted because he was obviously a ghali. So two important questions come in my mind right now. One is, were there ghulat that were not known and they were sort of spies who were fitting into chains? And number two, was there no room for somebody to come and write a hadith? In fact, three questions. Were the sanad of those hadiths being written such that, you know, we know where they come from? And three, was it possible for somebody to come just add a hadith
in
there?
I was going to come to this. Let me just quickly make one more last point and then we'll come to this.
Okay.
We'll try and answer this, okay? So, after all of this, is that it? No, that's not. Again, there's another system in place where the imams have pushed the companions. Wherever you're stuck, wherever you don't understand the hadith, regardless of who you've got it from, okay, keep that bit aside. You don't understand the hadith, come and present it to us. Ask us, we'll tell you what it means. Okay, so for example, there's an individual.
Are you talking about where it comes from or what it means?
What it means.
Okay.
So it's not even so, you know, we said that culture is changing, scholars not realizing what has really happened. So the Imam has told them that, look, at any point you see something that sounds fishy, that seems fishy, you don't understand it, you don't know where it's come from, ask us. Mm. Come and present it to us. Okay? So for example, there's one instance. Okay, there's loads of them. Okay, from the time of the Prophet, the system has been in place. Amir al-Mu'mineen, Abu Abdullah alayhi salam, all the Imams have had this. The time of Imam Bakr alayhi salam and onwards, obviously, it becomes keeps becoming more prominent. Imam Kadhim, Imam Ridha alayhi salam. Okay, these things become more prominent. The more intellectually the community advances, the more questions arise, the more they go to the Imam to understand the hadith. Mm. Because at the end of the day, you're going to have questions. It's not like everything that you're listening, you already know it from before, yeah. Right? Okay, so in one instance, Imam Kadhim alayhi salam finds an individual, okay? He's not even a Shia, okay? And Imam sees that, you know, this person, Imam can guide him. So he gets this individual, this individual is very pious. So Imam Kadhim finds him, and then he encourages him to go learn the deen, okay? But now this individual is not a Shia, right? So he's not going to come to Imam Kadhim. Imam Kadhim is not even going to tell him, come to me, okay? So he asks Imam Kadhim, who should I go to? So Imam Kadhim tells him, go to the scholars that you know of, go to them and learn the hadith, come back, and then if you don't understand something, tell me, I'll tell you what's right and what's wrong. So this guy goes the first time, he comes back to the Imam says, no, all of it is batil, for example. Okay, but this is because, in this case at least, this guy had become fond of Imam Kadhim, so he had accepted Imam Kadhim's...
as a scholar at least.
Yeah, yeah, and then he eventually becomes a Shia and so on and so forth. But we have so many narrations where individuals would go to the Imam and ask them, they would ask them, look, we found this hadith, it doesn't make sense. Or for example, we heard of this hadith from our brothers in faith from the Ahlul Sunnah, okay? They're quoting it from the Prophet, but it doesn't make sense to us. Can you explain it to us? So we have so many ahadith like this, okay? It makes it clear that the Imams were there even, you know, the Imams were present. Mm. They were always encouraging companions to come to them.
They're aware of what's happening in the whole...
in the community. They're not sitting in their room.
The academic community.
Yeah, they're not sitting in their room and they're unaware of what's happening in this city, that city. They have the Imams themselves that spies... okay, they have messages coming across. They had representatives in different parts of in different cities. Okay, and they would be getting messages. They'd be aware of what's really happening. Mm. Yeah. Okay. In line of this again, Zayd bin Abi Hilal. Okay, one companion. Okay, he sees traditions from Jabir bin Yazid al-Jawfi. Yeah, Jabir bin Yazid al-Jawfi is a very interesting character. He's got really beautiful ahadith. Some scholars of Rijal consider him a ghali, for example. So they'll reject his ahadith. Okay? So Zayd bin Abi Hilal sees some traditions from him. He doesn't understand them. He goes to Imam. Before he starts speaking, Imam curses. Zayd bin Abi Hilal, these traditions he sees, he feels that they're very similar to the teachings of Mughira,
okay,
the ghali. That's where the question comes up, okay? So he goes to the Imam, okay? And before he can say anything, Imam straight away starts praying for Jabir, okay? And starts cursing Mughira.
Interesting.
Yeah? So again, this idea was that even about individuals, the Imam, the companions would even be, they were free to, and they were allowed and encouraged to even go to the Imam and ask them about the companions as well, that, okay, this guy, is he a Shia? Is he a Ghali? Is he something else? Okay, again, I'm not saying that Jabir is definitely a Shia or is he a Ghali. We know that, okay, there's a difference of opinion over here. But the idea that existed and the concept that existed in the minds of the scholars and the companions, that we can go to the Imam and ask him anything that we like. And we make sure we assess all the information that we have with the Imam. We make sure that we stay in line with the Imam and the knowledge of the Imam, and we understand what the Imam wants us to learn.
Okay, so from this we get the idea that the Imam was somebody who is there active and involved in this whole academic process. He wasn't like a person just watching what's happening and not getting involved. He was actually there in the middle of it all, hearing what's happening, you know. So basically his presence was felt in that whole academic circle.
Yeah, okay. So this is generally the period of the Imams, okay? Now, after this, what's happening again, the ghulat kept going on. We have ghalis even today, okay? Proper factions of ghalis.
Yeah.
What would happen now, the companions at one point, obviously, they had to be careful, right? And they were worried about the ghulat infiltrating into the Shias, okay?
Yeah.
So this is where they became very cautious, okay? When it comes to the books of Rijal, okay, there's two things which is that is happening. The first thing that's happening is that when they see individuals, okay, the scholars of Rijal, okay, the scholars of Hadith, the initial scholars of Rijal and Hadith,
yeah,
when they see that an individual has too many traditions speaking about the Imams and the sifat of the Imams and the positions and levels of the Imam, but he doesn't speak about wajib and haram, they'd accuse him of ghulu, okay, because of this fear that we don't want the community to go into this line too much. Not that we are afraid of them learning about the Imam, but you know, because the ghulat is that line that separates the ghulat from, if you start speaking too much about the Imams, you might fall into this idea of calling them Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and some sort of rububiyah and uluhiyah, and then you'll start forsaking your wajib al-haram. So this is one thing that happened.
Okay.
Again, very quickly, few examples. Kashi is asking his teacher Ayashi about a few narrators. One of them, okay, Ayashi says about him that, look, the ghulat are tested at the time of prayers. Okay, I don't know if this guy prays, so I can't. I was never with him at the time of prayers, so I don't know if he's a ghali or not. So I can't say anything about him. Another example, Muhammad bin Urameh. Okay, the Qummis accused him of being a ghali. Okay, not the scholars, the people themselves. Okay,
yeah.
They decided that we're gonna kill him. We're gonna murder him.
Well, okay.
This threat of ghalis is serious.
It's a serious threat. Yeah. Okay.
Okay. Okay. We're not saying that they should be murdered, but it's a severe threat. So the Shias joined together, and they decided to murder Muhammad bin Urameh. They surrounded his house at night, and they see him praying Salatul Layl. And then it's okay, he's not a ghali, let's just leave
him. Interesting. So literally, your acting on the Sharia was sort of a sign that you don't have those, you're not a ghali basically. So being a ghali, not being a ghali is not about talking highly of the Imams, right? It's about, it's a different meaning completely.
Now the second thing that's happening, okay? Now the books of Rijal are not only assessing individuals. Why? Because the ahadith have reached us through books. And when a book is written, it's not like everyone just keeps making a book out of it. These books are transmitted, right? Okay. So you've written a book. I take the book from you and then I pass it out to someone else. The scholars of Rijal, first of all, don't need to speak about me. So that's why we have lots of ahads.
But aren't you able to add something to
it? Okay. When you have proof that there's sima and qira'ah that has been taken place and you just pass this book on to me, the scholar of Rijal doesn't need to come and speak about me anymore. Okay. Because this book has passed on with the necessary evidence. Okay. That is from you. And there's so many copies of this book out there. Okay. It's like, you know, you take a risala right now of Atlasistani and then you start, you know, putting in false ahkam in it. This book has false ahkam. That book has false. How many versions can you just come and, you know, put the wrong details in? Right. So now a lot of commenting that's happening in the books of Rijal. But again, if you read all the details that are there in the books of Rijal, not just the first part that says that this guy is a thiqa or this guy is not a thiqa. When you read a lot of the details together and you understand how the books of Rijal work, you realize that a lot of commentary that's happening is based on the books. So for example, Sheikh Tusi is saying that Ibn Walid doesn't accept this book, or he rejects a few of the riwayat and the traditions from this book, or Najashi coming and questioning the students, the scholars of Qum, and saying that, okay, Ibn Walid doesn't accept this, but I don't see any issue in it. There's no ghulu in this book. Why should I not accept it? Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of commenting that's happening on the content, not on the chains of narrators. Mm-hmm. Okay, and that's why when you come to this chain-based system of Rijal, you're stuck, because there's only 33% of narrators, for example, that you can actually assess, and 60% of narrators or 70% of narrators can't be assessed. Why? Because a good amount of them were just the links in transmitting these books.
Interesting. Yeah. So there was basically no room for you to just come and add a hadith from yourself and write us a
false sanad. That's the question. If really fabrication is taking place, like really where is there room for fabrication? So the teachers tell us that if something is to be fabricated, then khayli khub baftant. Like they fabricated really well, so well. It's not just one hadith.
And they were super smart.
Basically. No, and where do you fabricate? You fabricate the books, the aqaid, for example. Okay? And then you have to take this person's ahkam, and then you fabricate his ahkam as well. And then you fabricate history, and then you fabricate like everything that you can get your hands on. And they fabricated so well that when you put them together, you see that, you know, it forms a complete picture of religion. Yeah? Like, for example, you have in the Quran, for example, that Allah offered the amana to the different existences and insan accepted it. And the ghali sees this, for example, and comes and says, oh, assalamu alayka ya amin Allah. He's linking the Quran to the hadith. So he's got this understanding that the Quran, this is an important concept. Let's fabricate a hadith word. Again,
the ghulat understood
the Quran so well that they made sure that today we can come today and say that, look, all the traditions that we have about the imamah are in line with the Quran.
That's a bit far-fetched. So basically the idea, just to summarize and put in different words, what you're suggesting is that if there was so much fabrication, okay, and when we see at these when we look at these ahadith, they match a lot the content of the Quran. So basically, the ghulat would have to be super smart and super organized and really looking far ahead to be able to make everything fit so well to come up with a very, very strong concocted story.
But everything can today be explained in light of the Quran and the hadith and the historically and the intellect as well. Yeah. You can't poke holes easily into these.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I'll just end with these two points.
Okay.
I know we made a big deal about this whole sanad system, but when you come to the Hawza, again, and we've seen this, right? Even the scholars today, and for that matter, from the start until today, how many scholars do you really have who only stick to the sanad system? Where, for example, if you have a good sanad, you accept the hadith, and if you have a bad sanad, you reject the hadith. We were counting once, and we made it to 5. We might make it to 10 scholars from the time of Kulayni, or from the time the earliest books that we have, until today. So yeah, if you want to talk about prominent scholars, maybe 5, 6, you won't make it to more than 10 prominent scholars who really, really stick to the system and abide to the system strongly. Right? And what are the scholars doing? Again, the scholars, okay, they've read the books of Rijal, right? They've read the arguments, they've read the usuli principles as well behind the system. They understand. And yet, when it comes to their istinbat and ijtihad, what do? They give importance to what's come in these books because they know how strong the system was in place that has brought these ahadith to us. So they give importance to the narrators and who's transmitted these ahadith. They give importance to the opinion of the old scholars because you can't completely cut yourself off from these old scholars and say that, okay, I understand something differently. This is what's been passed on to us from that time until today.
So basically, these scholars who might focus a lot on the sanadi aspect of things, I guess this is what they're convinced with?
Yeah, they're convinced with. Is there
ijtihad? It's a scholarly matter. Yeah. But is that so the idea comes that maybe they were very strict and the other scholars are a bit lax? Would you call it
They can be strict. But again, if you go to these other scholars, the majority of the scholars, they themselves criticize this approach that, look, there's no room for this.
Okay, so they are consciously not using the sanadi method.
Today, we can speak about the scholars today and say, you know what, these guys are, you know, they want to hide the truth or they don't want to accept what has passed on to us. Okay, but that's not the case. I was looking at something from Muhakkik Hilli today. So he's right next to his contemporary of Allama Hilli, right? We're looking at Muhakkik Hilli today, and he's criticizing individuals who only stick to the sanad. And he's like, you know what? If you stick only to the sanad, what you're doing is you're doing a sort of tohma on, and you're accusing all the scholars of the past, all the companions of the imams themselves, really. That how did they let all these teachings reach us? Yeah. So, I mean, scholars in the past also have had this understanding. Allama Hilli himself, who's sort of invented and presented this idea amongst the Shias, he himself, in his fiqh, he doesn't stick to the system. In the books of fiqh, which are more for the Ahlus Sunnah to follow and look into, okay, where he's brought in the views of the Ahlus Sunnah, yes, he uses the system. But when it comes to his own books of fiqh, which is writing for the Shias, he doesn't use the system. He looks at what the scholars of the past have said. He doesn't easily call the hadith dha'if and push it aside. Yeah,
Basically, those scholars who do not stick to the purely sanadi method consciously do not. No, it's not out of, oh, we can't be bothered. No. They consciously do not agree that this is the right way.
They are still strict. They do look at the sanad. It's not like they don't know ilm al-rijal, for example, or they don't want to look at the sanad. They do all of this.
Yeah. But they're strict in authenticating the hadith in that second meaning of authentication. Which means let's be sure by putting the different factors together if this really comes from the imam.
And when we do put all these things together, it is quite clear that these books of ahadith, especially the books which are renowned, which the books that have been approved by Najashi and Sheikh Tusi, and they've come from us, those early books that have reached us from those times. So books like Kafi, the books of Sheikh Saduq, many of them, right? These books have come to us from a safe channel. Sheikh Tusi's own books as well, right? These books have come to us from a safe channel, and all the evidence clearly proves that it was a strict and rigid system where there wasn't room for fabrication such that you can push aside, I don't know, 30, 40, 50, 60, 70, 80, 90% of the book.
So
when
so,
does it mean that we don't have Zaif hadith? What does it mean then?
You said 80% of our narrators were called Zaif on the accusation of ghulu. So how does that work?
Okay, again, this goes back to the idea that the two points that I mentioned. One, the idea that their books, when the scholars of Rijal Najashi Sheikh, when they're looking at them, they're looking at what works these guys have worked on. So for example, the teachers tell us, bring us one narrator of hadith who's got a book on fiqh, narrator of hadith at the time of Imam, who's compiled a book of fiqh, okay, and books of aqaid, but who's got a book of fiqh, and the narrator might have called him a ghali. Mm-hmm. You don't. But when it comes to individuals who are only speaking about the Imams, for example, okay, the scholars will then say, okay, there's accusation that he's a ghali, or there's an understanding that he's a ghali. Okay, that's one. Okay, two. Again,
just for number one, so it's possible that that guy is not a ghali, but because of the very sensitive nature
because they
want to avoid falling into a pitfall, so they just term him as this is potentially a ghali.
So this is point number two. Does it mean that they don't quote from his books anymore? No. They're looking, because we said, right, the assessment is based on the books. It's not focused primarily on the individual. It's first focused on the books and then the narrator of the book.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So now when they look at the books and they're assessing the books, then, okay, we have some evidence that he might be a ghali, he might be inclined towards ghulu, but he's got traditions. We're going to look at these traditions. We're going to bounce these off against the traditions that we have. Okay, that we're sure of from the right books, from the trustworthy narrators. Okay. And then the ones that are good for us, we'll take them.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, if you go in Al-Kafi, okay, you have traditions from those who are called ghulu, even ghali, even today. Right next to it, you'll have traditions from Abu Basir, from Zurara, from these notable companions. Mm-hmm. Very similar hadith, very similar in words.
Sort of showing that the content of these hadiths are matching.
Yeah, and Kulaini is aware of this, so he's taking from these. And he's also taking from these to build up enough hadith so that someone doesn't come and say, that, oh, we don't have enough hadith on this content. So he's taking up enough hadith. Yes, fair enough, he's a weak narrator, but the content is completely in line with this content. Let alone the fact that he's not probably even a ghali, but some narrators have, some rijalis might have called him a ghali.
Mm.
Leaving, let alone that fact, when we take his content, we see that this is completely in line with our teachings, right? And wherever there's an issue, the rijalis like Najashi and Sheikh Tusi, at least, we're looking at these, right? They make sure to point it out, at least as far as their books of rijal are concerned. So they mention that, look, our teacher Saduq or our teacher Ibn Walid, for example, had an issue with this book. Najashi will come and say that, no, I don't agree with this. Or for example, some places Ibn Walid will approve of a book. And you realize, okay, wait, Ibn Walid, with all his strictness, his approval of Zira Jamia. He doesn't have an issue with Zira Jamia. Yeah. So you realize, okay, fair enough. Maybe this Sanadi system might not allow you to accept the Sanad, for example. But in terms of content, the likes of Saduq, the likes of Sheikh Tusi, and more importantly, Ibn Walid, one who is the most strict teacher in the Hawza of Qom at that time, is approved of this. Yeah. So they let go of this. And then Najashi also will accept and let go of this. He won't critique or comment on it. But there are instances where they will reject a book. So for example, it's even possible that I've written three books. Najashi will come and accept two of my books. And then he'll say, oh, no, this third book has an issue. I don't want this book. I'll keep this aside. But the other two books are fine. And then we're going to quote from it as well.
So basically, it's really interesting that even the Rijalis were always after what did Imam really say, and sticking literally to the Sanad. And because the weak person, that means we scrap him off.
Even
the Sanad is one of the factors.
Yeah,
it's just a
helping
factor.
It's one of the factors that we need to look at. It's one of the criteria, but it's not the strongest criteria, and it's not the only criteria.
Mm.
By far, it's the only criteria.
So obviously, from an academic perspective, those of our ulama who decide to stick to this methodology, we have respect for them. But then it's a difference of academic opinion. And most of our scholars from that time to today, as you said, they do not stick to this.
We have the same in aqaid, we have the same in fiqh, that we have the majority, the famous, the prominent understanding of the scholars of Qom or of Najaf from all these centuries. And there's individuals then who have, based on their own ijtihad, okay, with all due respect to that, but they have their own views. Okay.
Mm.
Now, having said this, and we'll inshallah, I can end with that.
Yeah, we need to wrap it up.
Having said that, okay, two questions come up. Okay, one of them then. There's so many ahadith that we open them today and we don't understand them. What do we do with them? One. Number two, does it mean that every single tradition that we have in the books of fiqh, we should act upon them, for example, or, you know, we should just act upon them, and we know there's conflict between them. Okay, so first the second answer. Okay, the scholars will tell us clearly that, look, you can look at the sanad, you can look at the chain, you can do all this analysis. Okay, the main place where you let go of a hadith, okay, you don't act according to it, is where you see the scholars, for example, not acting according to it, or the scholars acting against it. Okay, or for example, them seeing ta'arud and conflict between two traditions, then it's obvious one of them has an issue. Yeah, we can't always figure out.
And when you say conflict, we mean literally head to head conflict,
yeah,
right?
We can't solve them. Okay, but historically, we're not in a position to figure out why this conflict happened. Why? Because these were at two different times. The situation was such that the imam gave one ruling to someone and a different ruling to someone else. They were in two different regions. They were in two different times. There's so many different possibilities. Okay, like Al-Sistani himself has worked on some of these possibilities as to what different possibilities result in these conflicts between traditions. Okay, some people have listed 50 to 70 reasons as to why there can be conflicts between them. Okay, so this is one reason. When you see conflict and you can't solve them, then you're forced to push aside.
Yeah.
But if there's no good enough reason, then sanad is the last thing that you're looking at to just brush aside a hadith.
Yeah.
Okay, so this is one. Point number two. Literally, there are a hadith. We open them today. The scholars haven't explained it. Okay, let's say traditions in Bihar al-Anwar, for example, and in Kafi itself, in Sheikh Saduq's books. Okay, scholars have mentioned these hadith. I mean, the author has mentioned these ahadith. The scholars haven't explained this, okay? And it's not necessarily a fiqh hadith, okay? Now, what do we do? Okay. Again, individuals will come and tell you that, look, first of all, if we don't understand something, throw it away. And that's why I was telling about the Quran, right?
Mm.
We'll not understand it, we'll push aside the Quran as well, God forbid. Okay? So with hadith, we don't understand it, push it away. And then, we don't understand this, it means it's fabricated. There's a good possibility, a good number of ahadith were fabricated. Let's just push aside all the ahadith. Okay?
And we put under question the scholar who brought this hadith in his book as well.
Everything. And then again, it goes back to the imam. You can take it back to the imam. What was the imam doing? How have these traditions come from him? Okay? Very quickly, and we'll end with this, inshallah. Okay? The imam, okay? There's so many traditions over here, okay? Where the imam says, and he gets upset with companions, okay? For being so strict and so narrow-eyed with regards to ahadith, that if they don't understand something, لَمْ يَقْبَلْهُ, they don't accept it. إِشْمَأَزَّ مِنْهُ, their heart like lights up and they're upset about it. Okay? وَجَحَدَهُ وَكَفَّرَ بِمَنْ دَانَ بِهِ, so they reject it, and they reject the person that they were believing in, so they reject the imam as well. Sometimes it gets to a point where they want to reject the imam as well. Okay? And the imam is saying that وَهُوَ لَا يَدْرِي لَعَلَّ الْحَدِيثَ مِنْ عِنْدِنَا خَرَجْ وَإِلَيْنَا أُسْنِدْ فَيَكُونُ بِذَلِكَ خَارِجًا مِنْ وِلَايَتِنَا. This guy, he's rejecting the hadith. He doesn't realize that maybe it's come from us. He doesn't understand the meaning. And by pushing aside this hadith, he's leaving our wilaya. Okay? Again, there's lots of other hadith where the individuals even ask the imam. Again, we said, right, the individuals would ask the imam. So the individual asks the imam their hadith. I don't understand. What do I do? It's a common thing.
Yeah.
And the imam responds to them that ما علمتم أنه قولنا فلزموه. What you understand is from us, accept it and act according to it. Okay, stick, abide to it, abide by it. وما لم تعلموا فردوه إلينا. فردوه إلينا. What you don't understand, throw it back to us. But don't say it doesn't belong to the imam. Don't say it's a lie, it's a fabrication, and the imam didn't know or the companions didn't know, and so on and so forth.
Just like we had said in the third session with Sheikh Kadhim, that when we come, every hadith has sort of one haq on us and one duty. The haq
Definitely.
That we cannot
exactly
just push it away, but also the duty that we need to make sure that it is from the imam, from the different ways.
Yeah.
Very good. So a final thing, we have certain hadiths that are clearly, definitely fabricated and come in the books. How do we deal with that? Is there a big amount? We've said there isn't a big amount of it, but is there any reason, possible reason?
At the end of the day, you need proof to reach conviction.
Hmm.
If you're able to prove through the right techniques, again, not through the techniques that we mentioned, sit, read, not understand, we push it aside. Through all the techniques, if you're able to come to a hadith where bayni wa bayna Allah, all the scholars will easily accept your judgment, okay, then fair enough, we can push this aside.
So there is room, there is room for that small amount of tahrif and fabrication.
There is room, we're not going to deny, we're not going to say...
Sorry. I said tahrif, I didn't mean tahrif in the Quran.
Yeah, no.
The certain amount of fabrication in the hadith, there is a small room for this.
Even fabrication, we can't even call this fabrication. It's more like these traditions have reached us. Are we sure that someone sat, made up a hadith, and included in our books and our scholars didn't understand and brought them in? That's not always the case. There can be multiple reasons. Yes, agreed that fabrication has happened, especially in the other schools of law, other schools of thought. They themselves have pointed it out. Okay, but to say that a lot of fabrications have entered our book and we've been able to establish, yes, there are individuals. Yes, I might sit today and say that, okay, I don't understand this hadith. It seems it's fabricated. But another scholar is able to come and explain it. And again, we have traditions which tell us, and traditions like this, that how often is there someone who carries fiqh, but he's not a faqih. And he carries it to someone and that person is afqah min. He's a stronger scholar. So you might not understand it. You might want to consider it fabrication. If you're convicted and you have sufficient proof, fair enough. But that keep it yourself, because there's another scholar who's strong enough, who understands religion much better, and he's able to find the right place of this hadith so that he can interpret it in the right way. So for example, Allama Tabatabai, it is said about him that his student, Sheikh Yahya Ansari Shirazi, okay, he would say that we would look at the traditions of Kafi and Bihar before going to his class, because Allama Tabatabai used to interpret hadith. Yeah, so we'd look at the hadith and we'd say, definitely this hadith, by no way is this hadith a sahih hadith. Allama is going to reject this hadith. We'd go to class, we come back and we're like, subhanallah, we've understood what this hadith means. Yeah? So there are scholars out there who are so skilled at understanding the religion.
So basically, again, like we had established this previously as well, it's nice how things are forming together with Sheikh Kazim, that look, we have certain principles in religion, certain fundamentals. So when we come across a hadith which is not clear, if we're able to bounce it off these fundamentals and give it a meaning that is in line with these fundamentals, then there's no reason to reject and put it aside, right? Because we have established these fundamentals, then this is completely in line with it. And also taking into consideration that we don't have so many of these ahadith. Yeah. So if we had like a majority of our hadith that were fabricated, then that would make more sense. But from what you've explained to us today, it's very clear that the number of fabricated hadiths are not so many. So many of those that are accused of fabrication are actually not understood well. Yes, there's a small portion that are fabricated.
We can grade these. Yeah. So instead of saying it's either fabricated or not fabricated, or we either accept it or we reject it, push it aside, call it a lie, we can do this. Okay, which book is it coming from? You know, we take criteria. Okay, let's say on a scale of 10. Which book is it coming from? Okay, this book is a good book. It's coming from Kafi. Okay, Kafi is a very strong book. Okay, who's the scholar who's written it, for example? Okay, Kulaini, for example. Which period has it been written in? Okay, we take these criteria. Then we bounce it off the Quran. Is it in line with the Quran? It's not. We can't find a clear verse that it's in line with. But we don't see the Quran opposing it clearly either. Okay, so, okay, I'm not going to reject on that purpose. Is it in line with what the scholars have been saying until today? Yes, it's in line with what the scholars have been saying today. Oh, okay, so that's a plus point for the hadith.
So now let's read.
So we grade it. Okay, we reach a point. We understand now finally. Yes, we accept it. We know now what the hadith means. If we're not able to do that, then just keep it aside. That's exactly what the Imam is saying. That when you don't understand it and you really feel that this is something that can't have been from the Imam, bounce it back to the Imam. Let the Imam keep it. Maybe there will come a time where the Imam will come and tell us, inshallah, that, okay, this hadith was really a fake hadith or a false hadith. Or he will come and tell us that, look, this hadith was narrated at the period of Taqiyya. Or, for example, this hadith was said for this reason, and it was a true hadith, but you failed to understand it.
Asantam. Thank you so much. There's so much more to discuss, but I think we need to stop it here because we're going way over time right now. So, inshallah, we have another session with you where we'll sort of be talking